radio. It's a matter of seconds. Everything's got to be so tight and perfect.
Well,
schedules.
And then there's the times when it's not. And
there's the times that we're on the air, exactly.
Yes.
Time for American Radio, of course. WHBC, am I being heard? Is that better? Talk louder?
Can't hear you. I'm on. I can hear myself. We're on. Can you hear yourself?
No, I'm not worried if I hear myself. As long as I'm coming through.
This is yet another time when it's not perfect.
I had a feeling.
Just carry on. You're on air.
Of course, it being Friday, we have been looking at Simon and Garfunkel for quite a while now. This is actually show number 12 dedicated to the music of Simon and Garfunkel. And we are in the latter part of the 70s into the early 80s is what we're going to be covering today. And let's see, we start off, where we left off was a little bit sad on last week's show. This is when Art Garfunkel's live-in girlfriend had
committed
suicide. Lori had basically killed herself in their apartment. And that was obviously devastating for him. And, of course, Paul wants to do everything that he can to try to help his friend. But, they're not a team any longer. They're just friends. And the friends that see each other, really, mostly for business reasons, right? Because everything seems to be thrusting them back together again. It's kind of like, considering Paul's determination to maintain a solo career, it's amazing how often they get pushed back together,
right?
Under various circumstances. But after a while, I'm going to be doing some reading from a book by Mark Elliott called Paul Simon: A Life, because it helps a little bit with the chronology. I edit it drastically as I go through it, because there's parts of it that I either am not sure I agree with the tone or even the chronology at times, but parts of it make sense well enough for me to continue to utilize it. But anyway, reading from that book by Mark Elliott, Artie had begun his own method of self-help in effect to try to sing his way out of his grief by reuniting with Jimmy Webb and the always dependable Roy Haley to record Scissors Cut, an album that he dedicated to Laurie. It was released in October of 1981, but despite generally good reviews, the critics liked it, Rolling Stone called it Art Garfunkel's finest solo album to date.
Hmm.
But it failed to break into the American Top 100 chart listings. It only got as high as number 52 in England. So basically, the album failed miserably, and this sent Artie into an even deeper into a downward spiral with feelings of guilt on one hand and worthlessness, and it's such a shame because he's trying to basically work his way through this, and the public were no longer that interested in what he was doing. But we should hear at least one song then from that album called Scissors Cut, a song that would be very appropriate considering what the 80s held for Art Garfunkel, a song called A Heart in New York.
New York, to that tall skyline I come, flying in from London to your door. New York, looking down on Central where they say you should not wander after dark. New York, like a scene from all those movies, but you're real enough to me. There's a heart that lives in New York. A heart in New York, a rose on the street. I write my song to that city heartbeat. A heart in New York, a love in her eyes, an open door and a friend for the night. worth a difference. So here's to you, New York.
Excuse me, Art Garfunkel working with Jimmy Webb for the second time on a full-length album. And quite frankly, I'm very surprised that that song didn't generate some interest for the album. It sounds, to my ears, so much like a Simon and Garfunkel song.
It does have that vibe.
Yeah, it feels like it's something, it just got, you know, it borrows a little bit from the feel of what they were doing around Bridge Over Troubled Water with a very New York-centric theme. Great production. His singing is excellent. It's a shame.
Get much more New York centric than that song.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So anyway, picking up then at this exact point then from the same book we were reading from, at about this time, Ron Delsner, then the most powerful concert promoter in New York City, who had carved out a niche for himself that had crowded out even Billy Graham as the number one rock and roll performance godfather of Manhattan, had begun talks with Gordon Davis, who was the Parks Commissioner of New York, about the possibility of putting on a free concert in Central Park. I can still see Gordon Davis's face in my head. I remember that man. The idea was to do something to help New York City. In the mid to late 70s, the city was in serious economic decline. Rents were low, thanks to the huge number of apartments still protected under rent control. And that had led to a virtual halt in construction of new dwellings and the improvements on old ones. A side product of that, crime was high, drugs were everywhere, and corruption throughout the police force was rampant. Taking a walk in what once had been the jewel of the city, Central Park, was most New Yorkers' idea of the surest way to commit suicide.
Yes. Even I heard about that.
The city's mayor, the jocular and endlessly self-promoting Ed Koch, decided that Delsner's notion of a free concert in the park was the perfect way to boost the city's morale, as well as his own mayoralty, which was teetering from a third-term exposure of widespread city corruption that had all but rendered him powerless. Koch believed the goodwill of the free concert could go a long way toward polishing his own badly tarnished image. How am I doing? Koch's expression. With this nod of approval from City Hall, Delsner wasted no time in putting together a record-breaking audio and video rights deal with HBO that depended upon who would be the star of the show. However, everyone on all sides agreed that it had to be New York's own Simon and Garfunkel. Delsner called Paul directly to prevail upon him to give something back to the city that had given him so much, and Paul said that he would do it if, and it was a big if Delsner could help him get Artie to agree. The promoter immediately began to put together the logistics of what would undoubtedly become the biggest musical event in the park's or maybe the city's history. Eventually, to Paul's surprise, Artie agreed to do the show. Eugene Lee was enlisted to construct the 160-foot rooftop stage to accommodate Paul's insistence on a full orchestra at a building cost of more than $750,000. When both the city and HBO balked at the money for the set, Paul reportedly paid to have it built himself, and by doing so became the single largest investor in the show. He saw it as both personal payback to New York and a great investment. Turns out he was correct on both counts. As the September 19th, 1981 show date got closer, a single ad appeared in each of the city's daily newspapers announcing the show. And that was all it took to set off Simon and Garfunkel fans into a frenzy Demand for the free tickets was unprecedented. At dawn of the morning of the show, people started arriving at the Great Lawn trying to secure their place in front of the stage. And by early evening, more than 500,000 had gathered, and the free show turned into an event with a live audience larger than Woodstock.
Crazy.
Can imagine that.
Well, no one had to worry about transportation, so.
It was an amazing time, amazing day for New York City. Imagine sitting in the park then with the stage set, as I recall it, on the eastern side of the park, facing the western side, and the sound waves like wafting across the park up to, like, say, the Dakota Building and everything else. And this is the summer right after John Lennon had been murdered in front of the Dakota Building, which was certainly on a lot of people's minds on that day, August 19th, 1981. Let's hear the opening track from that show then, taken from the subsequent album. It was a double album set called The Concert in Central Park, celebrating the reunification of Simon and Garfunkel. Here's the live version of Mrs. Robinson.
Ladies and gentlemen, Simon and Garfunkel.
Ed Koch made it onto any other albums. That was him doing the introduction.
Oh, okay.
In the very beginning. I just wonder if it was on any other rock and roll albums or any albums at all ever. Now, the opening track then from the concert in Central Park. What a moment it was for New York City. I don't think there's anything that's even come close to this event since then. It continued rolling through incredibly well-known Simon & Garfunkel hits like Homeward Bound, Into America. Paul would do a couple of solo tracks, Me and Julio Down by the Schoolyard, for example. At one point, he rather comically wanted to basically, well, he gave thanks to the mayor, the police department, the fire department, and all the guys selling loose joints in the crowd.
Nice.
And it was kind of funny because that day, apparently, there was a big bust at the 72nd Street Boat Basin on the west side of Manhattan in the Hudson River. But at the concert, whatever was happening, there were no drug arrests at all.
That's so nice.
The police were going out of their way to try to keep everybody calm and let it be a pleasant day. So if people were getting a little bit high, nobody was going to worry about it. Of course, as Tom and Jerry, Simon and Garfunkel were huge fans of the Everly Brothers, putting one of their songs even onto the Bridge Over Troubled Water album. So they went a little bit deeper this time, and they actually pulled another Everly Brothers song out of their hat to perform at this show. So here, this is the only time that this was ever released by them. Here's their version of the Everly Brothers song, Wake Up Little Susie. Short and very sweet. Of course, more Simon & Garfunkel songs followed. Scarborough Fair, April Come She Will. From that, Paul actually then went into like a bit of a solo bit, performing Still Crazy After All These Years and American Tune, along with his new song, Late in the Evening, that had been on his previous album that was just released. And Art actually came and did one of his own songs. He did the song that we just started our show with, A Heart in New York, as part of the show. And then Paul had a brand new song that he wanted to do called The Late Great Johnny Ace, which eventually does mention John Lennon by name, about the fact that he had been murdered senselessly just the previous December. And as they're playing the song, allegedly, as the story goes, apparently some young person, a guy, got onto the stage and started running at Paul, saying, I have to talk to you. And Paul's performing the song, and he Paul like froze. They grabbed the guy and they got him off of the stage. But the circumstances were a bit overwhelming.
I guess so.
At that exact point, Paul totally stopped, stepped away from the mic. God knows what he could have been expecting, because everybody at that moment had probably the same thing on their mind.
Right.
Eventually, he did stand up to continue the song. It didn't make the album, though, because of the interruption. And actually, from that point on, Paul never sang the song live.
Weird.
He would never do it again. He just felt that maybe something about the karma made it very inappropriate or difficult. So that was that. Anyway, they moved through the set, did a version of Kodachrome into Chuck Berry's Maybelline for fun. And then for the closer, which wasn't really the closer because they were brought out for about something like four encores.
Wow.
It was incredible. 500,000 people don't just let you go home, you know?
I guess not. I'm tired.
But here was the song that was going to close the set, and it's a rather beautiful version. I imagine on a beautiful summer day, this song basically just wafting over you in Central Park, the live version of Bridge Over Troubled Water.
When you're on the street, when evening falls so high, I will comfort you. I'll take your part. Oh, when darkness comes. Sail on, silver girl,
Well, that was a start for the end, and then they had an encore of The Boxer, and the crowd basically just kept bringing them back, and they came back. They performed a 59th Street Bridge song, Feeling Groovy.
Man, good thing they had a few encores lined up.
Right. And brought them back again, and they did Sound of Silence. It got to the point where they ran out of songs, and for the final encore, Paul asked the band to once again queue up late in the evening, do it a second time.
Wow.
And that's how they ended the show. One of those encores, though, was, of course, Simon and Garfunkel performing Old Friends, and the pithiness of it, I guess, was something that couldn't be overlooked. And that's why I've decided to include it here. Here it is from the concert in Central Park.
Like bookends, a newspaper blown through the grass falls on the round toes of the high shoes of the old friends. Old friends, winter companions, the old men lost in their overcoats, waiting for the sun. The sounds of the city sifting through trees settles like dust on the shoulders of the old friends. Can you imagine us years from today sharing a park bench quietly? How terribly strange to be 70. Old friends, memory brushes the same years, silently sharing the same.
That's quite a jubilant crowd, huh? Yeah!
I'll tell you, that song always affected me, and hearing it in that context, it was rather beautiful. It's funny also in context of thinking about, you write a song like that when you're young.
Yeah, and you don't expect to catch up to the numbers. And I was there hearing him say something about being 70.
How terribly strange to be 70, yeah. You know, it's basically about looking forward, and you think that you're going to grasp that, and you're capturing it in the song, maybe thinking one day I'll have that moment and this song will be part of my life. And that's exactly more or less what
I think that's where they
happened.
Are now.
Exactly. I mean, you write a song at 22, 23, and all of a sudden, I mean, these guys are very close to that age. I don't know. I don't have their birth dates in front of me, but, you know, we're near that. They're near that. And I just wonder, you know, how it feels now. Is there comfort in that song, or does it cause discomfort? Especially since you write it when you're so much younger. You know, you probably reflect on what you thought you knew and then realize that it's so much more complicated. Well, that being what it is.
So true.
Despite the fabulous reception that was received, neither Paul nor Artie were particularly happy with the show.
Really? Really?
Yeah. According to Paul, he said afterwards, our first reaction was, I think, one of disappointment, Arthur's more than mine. He thought he didn't sing well. I didn't get what had happened, how big it was, until I went home, turned on the television, and saw it all on the news, the people being interviewed, and later that night on the front page of all the newspapers. Then I got it.
When you're living it, it's hard to, you know, see the forest for the trees,
I guess. Yeah, exactly, exactly. Meanwhile, on May 28th in Offenbach, Germany, Simon and Garfunkel kicked off their planned world tour with the first of 14 major European concerts that would take them all over Europe and then into New Zealand. That leg of the tour lasted for the rest of 1982 and set them up for their largest North American tour yet after all these years. From Ohio to Michigan to Toronto to Chicago, Massachusetts, into Queens, New York, of course, New Jersey, Baltimore, Massachusetts, back and forth, Los Angeles, San Diego, Boulder, Colorado, everywhere they appeared. Audience adulation was as enthusiastic as it had been in Central Park. The world wanted Simon and Garfunkel back together. And for that summer of 1982, it was happening. Well, during a break in the tour, Paul remained in New York City to be with Carrie Fisher, his new girlfriend. And that's when Carrie told him that she wanted to get married. One night, not long after, Paul took himself to a Yankees game, sat alone to think things over, and decided before the bottom of the ninth that he would try marriage again for the second time.
Hmm.
He and Carrie tied the knot 5 days later in his duplex overlooking Central Park West. During another break in the tour, Paul took Carrie for a cruise down the Nile, followed by a visit to Kenya. It was on that trip that he made the decision that Artie would not appear on the new album that he was making after all, despite his having already recorded several vocal tracks for it. The reason was rather simple. He'd asked Artie to give up smoking pot and cigarettes, at least during the recording period, to keep his voice sounding better, but Artie said no. He refused to learn the songs in the studio with Paul. Instead, he insisted on taking them with him to Europe and listening to them on a Sony Walkman. Because Paul's reaction to all this was like, listen, I would be willing to do almost, and that word is important, almost anything to make Art happy. I care about our friendship. The only thing I feel I won't do is change the essence of my work. That was the crux of our problem on this new album. Then, through an official spokesperson, Paul released the following statement. Paul simply felt the material he wrote is so close to his own life that it had to be his own record. Art was hoping to be on the album, but I'm sure there will be other projects that they will work on together. They are still friends. Paul's marriage to Carrie, though, finally and totally collapsed by June of 1983. Rather short-lived marriage.
Yeah, I'll say.
Just several months after she completed shooting The Return of the Jedi. Meanwhile, Paul set to work to complete tracks on his album, and the first song that he had completed, the first completed track was a song called Allergies, which was the opening track on his new album, and he released it on November 4th, 1984, with a hot band and Al DiMeola playing the electric guitar solo. Unfortunately, the song failed to chart, so that did not bode well for the full album's upcoming release. And it put the same fear into Paul Simon that had happened to Art Garfunkel before the concert. All of that goodwill, all of that concert, the concerts that they had done for an entire summer of touring together, and the public is not buying the solo material. Here's that opening track from the album that would be titled Hearts and Bones. Here's the song Allergies.
Allergies to dust and rain. Melodies, remedies, still these allergies remain. Can't touch a guitar string. My fingers just burn and ache. My head at the seams with my bodily needs, and my body won't give it a break. My heart can't stand a disaster. My heart can take a disgrace.
but my heart is allergic to the women I love, and it's changing the shape of my face. Allergies, allergies, something's living on my skin. Doctor, please, open up, it's me again. If I go to a famous physician, I sleep in the local hotel. From what I can see, the people like me, we get better, but we never get well. So I ask myself this question, it's a question I often repeat. Where do allergies go when it's after a show and they want to get something to eat? Allergies, allergies, something's living on my skin. Open up, it's me again. Melodies, melodies, allergies to dust and rain. Melodies, remedies, still these allergies remain.
Hot single. Unfortunately, it didn't do much for Paul. I guess at the time...
I just can't understand that fickle public sometimes.
Well, the next song, I think, pretty much defined the album, and it provided the title. And I think it does give the heart and soul of the entire album. This album deserved much better than it got, in my opinion. I think the best tracks are some of the best things that Paul ever did in this song, especially with the line about him traveling to with his son. One and one half wandering Jews, as he puts it in the song. It's such a beautiful song about basically, you know, dealing with, you know, post-divorce relationships called Hearts and Bones.
One and one half wandering Jews free to wander wherever they choose, are traveling together in the Sangre de Cristo, in the blood of Christ mountains of New Mexico. On the last leg of a journey they started a long time ago, the arc of a love affair. Rainbows in the high desert air, mountain passes slipping into stone, hearts and bones, hearts and bones, hearts and bones. Thinking back to the season before, looking back through the cracks in the door, two people were married, the act was outrageous, the bride was contagious, she burned like a bride. These events may have had some effect on the man with the girl by his side, the arc of a love affair. His hands rolling down her hair. Love like lightning shaking till it moans. Hearts and bones. Hearts and bones. Hearts and bones. Hearts and bones. Why don't we drive through the night? We'll wake up down in Mexico. Oh, why? I don't know nothing about, nothing about no Mexico. And tell me why won't you love me for who I am, where I am? He said, 'cause that's not the way the world is, baby. That's not the way the world is, baby. This is how I love you, baby. This is how I love you, baby. This is how I love you, baby. Wandering Jews return to their natural coasts to resume old acquaintances and step out occasionally and speculate who had been damaged the most. Easy time will determine if these consolations will be their reward. The arc of a love affair waiting to be restored. You take two bodies and you twirl them into one. Their hearts and their bones, oh, and they won't come undone. Hearts and bones. Hearts and bones. Hearts and bones. Hearts and bones.
One of the most beautiful songs ever written about a divorce. I just such a great song. I spoke out of turn when I mentioned Paul's son, only because that song is so much like the theme of Graceland when he travels with his son to Graceland for similar reasons, you know, basically to assess a relationship. And of course, this one being about traveling with Carrie Fisher, the arc of a love affair, as as he puts it. The album was full of incredibly profound moments that stuck with me really for the rest of my life after I heard this album. And I was wondering why I seemed to be the only person that cared, because most of the people were just dismissing Paul Simon. I mean, it was the age of post-punk, and there was a lot that was going on in terms of change musically. So I guess it was maybe like looking backward. But the thing is, to me, it was like Paul Simon had passed through. He came through it, and he was still able to be himself, was still writing really valid material without trying to be something that he wasn't. And to me, that was the key. Too many of the people were basically trying to squeeze their art into the wrong box, but, you know, Paul wasn't doing that. And I think that he deserved much more credit than he got. Here's an example of what I'm talking about. There was like one song on the album called Think Too Much that was sort of an upbeat song that was okay. It was like, I wouldn't say filler, but it didn't really quite do it. But the slow version of the song with the same words I found to be profoundly intense in terms of what it was conveying emotionally. It probably stuck with me to this day. Here's that slower version of the song, Think Too Much.
Smartest people in the world had gathered in Los Angeles to analyze our love affair and finally unscramble us. And they sat among our photographs, examined every in the end, we compromised and met the morning sun. Maybe I think too much. Maybe I think too much. Oh, maybe I think too much. Maybe I think too much. Hey, say the left side of the brain, it dominates the right. And the right side has to labor through the long and speechless night. And in the night, my father came to me and held me to his chest. He said, there's not much more that you can do. Go on and get some rest. And I say, yeah. Maybe I think too much. Maybe I think too much. Oh, maybe I think too much. Maybe I think too much. Oh, maybe I think too much. Maybe I think too much. Hey, maybe I think too much. Maybe I think too much. Oh,
maybe it's because I relate.
Totally.
Love that song. Amazing. As I'm saying, the high spots on this album really moved me and stuck with me forever. There was there was another song on the album that Paul basically was going through an art book. And there was a photograph in the book of the artist and his wife, and they were smiling. They looked, you know, basically looked like they were happy and enjoying their life. And Paul, when looking at the photograph, imagined them smiling and dancing to doo-wop music, as Paul might have wanted to, because he was, you know, because it's what he loved. Mm-hmm. So he used the caption underneath the photograph for his title and named the song "René and Georgette Magritte with Their Dog After the War."
René and Georgette Magritte with their dog after the war.
return to their hotel suite and they unlock the door. Easily losing their evening clothes, they dance by the light of the moon to the penguins. The moon glows, the Oreos, the five saddles, the deep forbidden music they've been longing for. Renee and Georgette will greet with their dog after the war. Renee and Georgette will greet with their dog after the war. We're strolling down Christopher Street when they stopped in a men's store. With all of the mannequins dressed in the style that brought tears to their immigrant eyes. Just like the penguins, the moon glows, the Oreos, the five saddles, the easy stream of laughter flowing through the air. Renee and Georgette will greet with their dog Après la Guerre. Side by side, decades gliding by like Indians, time is cheap. When they wake up, they will find all their personal belongings have intertwined. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Renee Georgette will greet with their dog after the war. We're dining with the power elite, and they looked in their bedroom drawer. And what do you think they have hidden away in the cabinet cold of their hearts? The pen. The moon glows, the Oreos, and the five saddles. For now and ever after, as it was before, Renee and Georgette will greet with their dog after the war.
So sad. Critics loved it. The audience just didn't go for it. Some of the most profound stuff that Paul Simon had written in a long time in my mind. I mean, a song about an ideal love, what you would basically try to project upon, the ideal love. It's just so beautiful, that image. And then the album ends with the song that he vowed to never, ever perform live again. Of course, it is the song where he mentions John Lennon by name. And it's, again, an incredibly profound and beautiful song, making a comparison to that situation and something that happened way back in the 50s to around the doo-wop era when Johnny Ace killed himself backstage.
Right.
In a stupid accident. The song ends with a classical moment, like a string coda, written by Philip Glass, and that is how we'll end our show, with Paul Simon from the album Hearts and Bones performing the late, great Johnny Ace. But take care, everybody.
I was reading a magazine and thinking of a rock and roll song. The year was 1954. And I hadn't been playing that long when a man came on the radio, and this is what he said. He said, I hate to break it to his fans, but Johnny Ace is dead. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I really wasn't such a Johnny Ace fan, but I felt bad all the same. So I sent away for his photograph, and I waited till it came. It came all the way from Texas with a sad and simple face. And they signed it on the bottom from the late great Johnny Ace. Yeah, yeah, yeah. December evening, I was walking through the Christmas time when a stranger came up and asked me if I had heard John Lennon die. And the two of us went to this bar and we stayed to close the place. And every song we played was for the late great Johnny Ace.